Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Afterburn Podcast, episode number 11.
Altitude.
Tower, Delmar, Texas, release to you, runway 4 left, wind 040 at 5, clear for takeoff.
Sea tide, Altitude 0 eyes, we're clear for takeoff, clear for the airspace.
Fire protector.
Viper 01, be advised, the restricted area 6002 is still active.
My guest for today's episode is former Air Force Flight Surgeon Major Eric Sweller, better known as Knuckles. Let your imagination run wild with that call sign. But he is a former flight surgeon, taking care of a bunch of F-16 pilots out of Shaw Air Force Base, and now he is becoming an orthopedic surgeon. So big brain on Knuckles, but proud to call him a friend and happy to have him on the episode today. We're going to talk all about being a flight doc, what it means, and some stories that go along with that. Before we get rolling today's podcast, just a few admin notes. I'd also like to thank Hangar 24 Craft Brewing out in Redlands, California. They have additional tap rooms in Orange County and Lake Havasu. I'm excited because I work with Hangar 24 now, and I absolutely love the brand. I fell in love with it when I flew the Hangar 24 Airfest back in 2018. It's a phenomenal company. It's phenomenal beer. It's good people. I'm excited to see the expansion and where the company is going to be a part of it. I encourage you to swing by one of their tap rooms if you live near one. You can go over to hangar24brewing.com and find out more information or check out their social media, Facebook and Instagram. I'd also like to thank Squadron Posters, again, a company that I just absolutely love, and I've been a customer of theirs for several years. They have upped the game from just making posters to share the adventure and your journey through life. I would encourage you to swing by squadronposters.com and check out their bomber style artwork. It's a really cool way to display, again, your journey. And also, they have metal nose art. So if you want something that looked like it just came off the side of a plane with whatever graphic design you want on there, they can do that. Swing over to squadronposters.com and orders over $59 or more receive a 10% discount with the discount code RAIN10. That's RAIN10. I'd also like to thank Wingman Watches for sponsoring this podcast. Again, another company that I just absolutely love, and I love their products. If you're looking to build a custom watch, this is their bread and butter. You can work with their design team to commemorate your journey, your organization, your unit, whatever it might be, through a custom watch that's affordable and is high quality. Swing by wingmanwatch.com and you can use the code RAIN10 to receive a discount on any current watch that's on there, or you can mention my name to receive a discount on your group customization order. Mention my name to receive a discount on your group order, or if you see a watch you already love on the site, you can use the code RAIN10 to receive 10% off your watch purchase. And finally, I'd just like to ask, if you're enjoying the podcast, please hit subscribe, leave me a rating and review over on iTunes. That helps the podcast out. And with that being said, let's get into the podcast. You just say a couple words. Yeah, that's real nice. Again, each one of these, it just keeps getting better and better. So yeah, no, your audio sounds good. Well, Knuckles, man, I really am excited to have you on the podcast. I think people are going to find it fascinating what your career has been up to this point, what you're doing, because we're going to talk about medicine, which is something I don't know anything about other than it's like, yeah, it's an ibuprofen, because that's what you guys always issue us.
When 800 we have, milligrams.
Yeah, there you go. That'll solve everything. My arm's missing. Here's 800 milligrams of ibuprofen. But Knuckles, you're a former flight doc in the Air Force. We've flown together, worked together. Before you roll into the podcast, if you just kind of tell the listeners a little about who you are, what you're doing today, and how you got there.
Yeah, perfect. Thanks again, Rain, for having me on. I know we've been working to try to get this squared away, and due to scheduling conflicts, we've had to reschedule about 4 or 5 times. But
yeah, it might be like 7 times to include today, like no less than twice. So thanks.
Maybe 7 to 9.
Yeah.
I'm Eric Sweller. Grew up just outside of Dayton, Ohio, in a small little suburb. Went to college at Hillsdale College, which is in South Central Michigan. No federal funding to that college, so there was no ROTC. When I got there, played football for 4 years. We were Division II NCAA, so that was an awesome experience. And probably I'd say towards the latter half of my high school years, I knew I wanted to get into medicine. So I kind of geared all of my training in undergrad to get into medicine, applied my junior year, and I got into the West Virginia School of Osteopathic Medicine, which is down in Lewisburg, West Virginia. So I completed that in 2014, and then I did a one-year internship, basically a traditional rotating internship where you dabble in a little bit of everything in medicine just before you would either go to a full-up residency or potentially go out and practice as a general practitioner. In college, I applied for the HPSP scholarship, which is the Health Professions Scholarship Program. It's one of the awesome opportunities the Air Force provides where they will fund your professional education for a service commitment on the back end of things. Downsides to it that I didn't know from the get-go were that when you go to apply for residency, you have to apply through the Air Force first, and they have to give you like the grace of you can go do whatever you want to do, or we're going to tell you what to do.
There's always fine print.
Exactly. So I went through that application process and got spun off to the traditional rotating internship year as a civilian. So I did that where my wife was doing her pediatric residency. And then the next year I reapplied through the whole process. And that's when I got my orders that said, you're going to be a flight surgeon and that you're going to be tracking to Shaw Air Force Base with the 79th Fire Squadron with the Tigers. So for me, I was like, sweet. Don't really know what that means exactly, but you know, let's go do it.
And, this will be fun.
Yep. And so then I showed up to Shaw Air Force Base and, on July 8th, it was the day after the midair down by Charleston. I remember that like clean as day because I'm watching the news going, huh, that's where my base is.
Yeah.
And it was just really wild to walk onto base the next day and everything was like a ghost town there, like quiet because they did a down day the following day. And then as the shooters were just getting ready to head out for Red Flag, I think, because they were gearing up for their deployment. So everything was just a ghost town. And I was just trying to figure out like, where do I go for the first check-in spot and how do I not mess up day one?
Yeah. That's crazy.
And yeah.
I think probably different, you know, for a pilot showing up to Shaw to go fly an F-16. Yeah. You went through pilot training, then you go out to the B course and you've been with probably a certain set of people for at least 9 months. And then you're going to have a couple buddies who are already at the squadron flying, as well as some guys are showing up. So you kind of have, I would, for a lack of better phrase, like you have someone to hold your hand there to kind of like help you and point you out. But it sounds like you just literally rolled into like the base and said, hey, I'm new here. Where do I go? I mean,
so luckily we had Gerbil Funk. So Brian Funk, who's longtime active duty guy, who's now working as a GS at Shaw. And he's basically like the godfather for flight docs at Shaw. Like he will guide you in, make sure you got everything squared away, and basically gives you like a, here's where to go on base and how to get there and what to do.
We'll backpedal a little bit. What made you want to go into the Air Force and pursue medicine in the Air Force? Because obviously a lot of different avenues you could have gone down, but what pushed you that direction?
Yeah. So for me, you know, I grew up, my parents, nobody was really in the service. Both my grandfathers served during World War II. My one grandfather was a B-24 navigator, in the European theater. So pretty cool to like talk with him about stories. And then, he did a full career with the Army Air Corps back in the day. And then, he transitioned over to like the Army medical side and like public health. And then my other grandfather was a dentist for 3.5 years or 4 years. He was in that time when they did the fast tracking through college and professional training. So he actually never graduated with an undergrad degree. They fast tracked him 3 years and then he went to dental school and he was a dentist. So it was pretty wild to hear that story from my grandma. But I think for me, it was just always a desire to serve the country in some fashion or one capacity or the other. But I always wanted to serve in a function of, I wanted to be a physician. I knew I wanted to do that. And so In high school, I did some research of like, how can I make this happen and do what I want to do and still serve the country. I actually got a letter that said that you're not fit for service.
Yeah, that was what
happened. So I called my recruiter and I go, hey, man, like, I've played 4 years of college football. Like, I'm not sure what's going on here. Like, why can't I serve the Air Force? And I think we had to like write a letter to the Air Force Surgeon General just to get the approval to go to MEPS. And so we finally got a letter that said, yes, you can go to MEPS. And so I got that. So that put me on a year pause of like the whole process because you had to basically start all over again. And so, yeah, I went through that and then I got in during my first year of medical school.
Some themes I hear there, right? Like, it's a pretty long-term goal with a lot of like hurdles to overcome, which translates, I think, to any kind of profession you want to pursue, which, as I talked through the podcast, like that theme right there, I think is applicable to so many people, no matter what they're interested in. Like, again, long-term goal, there's going to be setbacks. You got to push through and persevere if you want to go out there and do it. The interesting thing, so it's funny. I don't know why you're like unfit for duty, but I know you're a pretty fit dude. There was a guy in my RGC unit who was just like jacked. And this is right about the time the Air Force changed the PT test to include, a waist measurement.
Oh yeah, man. And
the guy, I mean, again, he was just like huge and just like ripped, but his waist was like 36 inches, which was like over the limit. Or back then, I think it was like a massive like point reduction. Like, there was no way you could score like anything but like an 85. So it's just kind of ridiculous to see how things like progress. I think we're slowly getting better, you know, but you're like, seriously, this is the dude you want in the Air Force. He's just going to go out there and, you know, kill whatever you need killed.
Well, and on the same lines, when I met my recruiter the first time, we were getting ready to start my senior year of college football. And he's like, so how much do you weigh? And I was like, this defensive lineman and a punter. And I weighed 265. And he's like, you think you can cut some of that? And I go, not until the fall, not until winter, like when the season's over. He goes, all right, I think maybe we can like finagle a way where they'll do a neck waist measurement and do like the deduction component of things where they'll, you know, come up with your BMI based off of that rather than your height and weight. I was like, okay.
Yeah, whatever you just said, that sounds fine. Let's do that. It is funny, but I did see that just recently the Air Force got rid of the height requirements. I know that doesn't, like, I haven't read all the details. I know they're going to be, for being a pilot, there are going to be restrictions still. But I think before it was just a blanket, like, you must fit between these numbers. Yeah. And if you aren't there, we're not even considering you. So again, I haven't read it. I think that just came out like a day or two ago.
Okay. Yeah.
They're changing things. So maybe.
Yeah, man. I think they're in the process of changing a lot of things to make some tracking a little bit easier. But then I think they're also recognizing that there are certain things that maybe they were thrown out the door that, you know, they are maybe backpedaling on a little saying and going, it's not as risky as we initially thought maybe it was.
Now kind of fast forward, and you graduate college. What is COT and when did you go to COT?
Yeah. So COT is commissioned officers training. So in our program, you actually commission before you go to training. So you show up day one at training and you're a second lieutenant, which is mind-boggling at the same point as it is like a shock and awe factor, because you show up to Maxwell Air Force Base in middle of nowhere. Well, not really middle of nowhere, but Montgomery, Alabama. But it is training for your professional degree programs, primarily your physicians, your nurses, your optometrists, your lawyers, and your chaplains. I think that's the main grouping of them all.
I buy that.
And so you show up and it's a grueling 6 weeks.
Someone has to do it.
actually, what was it? Maybe it was 8 weeks. I don't know. We showed up, I think, right after Labor Day, and we got home right before 4th of July. So, no, I guess six to seven weeks.
Yeah.
And basically, it's learning your customs, courtesies, like just learning how to be an officer.
Nice. So jumping back into it, you show up to Shaw. And you're going to the 79th Fighter Squadron.
Loco.
Yeah. Double down. Yeah. Arguably the second best. So I'll give you that. What was it like rolling into the squadron? And what did your first year look like as a flight doc? And what is a flight doc for those people who don't understand?
Yeah. That was something I figured out pretty much in the first like four months of being there. So I showed up and I met our squadron commander. So it was Hyper Anderley at the time. And he pretty much just turned to me and he goes, dude, you need to go do your training. And then when you come back, like I've got stuff ready to go for you once you know what you're actually doing. He said, until then, I'll see you when you get back. And so literally I went up to the med group, got my check-in list, like started doing some in-processing stuff, and then had to learn how to get orders generated, which that took like 3 days to figure that process out.
Yeah, three full days.
And so literally I showed up and like, I think I showed up on the 8th and the 12th. I was on my way to TDY up to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for the aerospace medicine training classes that they have, the courses. So AMP 101, 201, 202, and 301.
And that's where they teach you how to issue ibuprofen for everything?
No, you learn that in medical school.
Okay. All right, just making sure.
And so, you know, for me, it was learning that you're the primary care physician for the squadron. So basically, it kind of like concierge medicine in that you are at the beckoning call of the squadron, wherever they need to go, wherever they need, you go with them. So the majority of the TDYs, you go with the squadron to be their medical element while they're there and basically help them get whatever they need. If medical is needed beyond just what you can provide out of a medication box that you bring with you. Paired with it, you know, responsibilities include also taking care of basically anybody on flight status. And that's where the AMP really kicks in, is it teaches you what your limitations are, medication limitations, because of impact to the potential to withstand like G-forces and things like that.
So in that training, you learn about the in-flight emergencies. So for us, like in the F-16, the EPU is a big one that we have to know about as far as how to manage, you know, if it fires, if it misfires, or if somebody doesn't know if it has or hasn't fired. So that was, you know, part of our training, as well as while you're there, you get some in-flight training as well, some instructed time behind the stick. So we got to go hop up in a Cirrus SR-22, a little sporty single prop, and fly around. And for me, that was the first time I'd ever experienced like flying in a small plane like that. And to be honest, like up until that point, I was like, man, I never want to fly in a plane like that.
That is night and day from like what your experience was to like going to fly right? an F-16, like, holy cow.
Yeah. So you go up there and you learn all the process. So how to do an initial flying class physical, how to do waivers. They do like your initial chamber certification there. It was already a wild experience. And so that was pretty cool. It's a little weird. And then you watch, and there was like a guy in our class who was in his 50s, and he went for the max time that they would allow him to be hypoxic underneath of that, like at that flight level that they simulate. He's just like nailing it. Like every question answered cold, like no issues at all. We're all like, man, what is wrong with that guy? Like something's not right there.
Smoked a lot of cigarettes or something. It's funny. When I went through the chamber, we actually had a guy who, similar story, the oldest dude, he was like returned active duty. He must've been like late 50s. And I remember same deal. He just sat there and they kept raising the altitude. Everyone like bows out, whatever, is getting hypoxic. And he just sat there like, well, this is really impressive. Turns out he was hypoxic. So, you know, he had to repeat the chamber ride, but you know, neither here nor there. It was a lesson learned, but that's something I'm curious to tie into. So actually I had two rapid decompressions at 43,000 feet. Yeah. So this is one that I played off, but can you explain what high altitude flying, like what are the risks flying around an F-16 or any fighter or any airplane for that matter up at that altitude, and all of a sudden you have a rapid decompression. So the cabin altitude goes to 43,000 feet.
Right. Yeah. So it all turns into like the internal pressure versus the external pressure. So, you know, when you take off and just like commercial airliners, most of them are able to pressurize their cabin to what, like 8,000 feet or something along those lines. And that's why they don't require you to use oxygen when you fly in those commercial airliners, because they're able to pressurize it to a level that is, you know, enough oxygen concentration to allow you to have basically no impact that you can notice.
The chamber fly was describing like the older guy in my group, where is that insidious, you know, he knew obviously, right? Because that was the exercise of raising the cabin altitude, but he didn't recognize his hypoxia symptoms. For my first one, I remember my visor fogged up. I'm like at 1.4 Mach. I'm at 43,000 feet, just cruising.
Sending it.
Yeah. I'm just gonna go wreck someone's house. That was my plan that day. And my visor kind of like fogged up. I'm like, that's kind of weird. And I touch it. I'm like, oh, that's condensation. So I looked down at the cabin pressure, and like right when I looked at it, it was like the chamber flight when they do the rapid decompression, and it's just like poof, and you're in a cloud. I was like, well, that's not good. So I just rolled and pulled and just thought skinny as I went diving through a couple formations just to get low. And I remember seeing 43, like as I was doing that, I looked, glanced, I saw 43 on the cabin altitude. I was like, well, that's not good. Just stay awake, you know? But I try to play it off. Like, and I got back to Shaw. There's obviously a little bit more to that story, but Gerbil met me at the end of the runway, you know, and checked me out, make sure I was good. I was like, yeah, I feel fine. And I'm going home that day, told my wife about it. I was like, yeah, like I'm good. No big deal. And everything was fine until the next morning when he called me like at 6 a.m. to make sure I was still alive. And that's when Anna knew. I downplayed it a little bit, but hypoxia is no joke. And that altitude is no joke. We've definitely lost a few guys who've lost consciousness at the altitude.
Cause basically it's the same thing happens as what happens with like divers and getting the bends. The worst is if you have like a neuro symptoms with it. So gait instabilities, vision changes, just like speech changes, anything that would be connected with the brain processing function. Those guys all get sent and they get to go dive in a chamber to basically bring them back to get the nitrogen levels out and things like that. So tying it in to like what I'm doing now. So now I'm in my orthopedic residency just outside of Detroit, Michigan at Garden City Hospital. And I was sitting in on a lecture probably second month I was here. And it was the sports medicine conference. And it was the University of Florida's team doc who was talking. And he hopped up and he basically was talking about what the role of the flight doc, or not the flight doc, but the team doc was for sports teams. And, you know, he tied in these three things. He said a leader provides service and sacrifice. And I thought it was very fitting in that you've got to serve the group you're with if you want to be a leader. And if you're serving them, you have to sacrifice for them. And I just thought, you know, that was so true. And that like, that probably put the best piecing of it all together for a flight doc is that you're going to make sacrifices because you have to build the trust of these guys that are already a unit. And you are the outsider coming in. And by the way, like you hold a pink card of basically saying like, hey man, you're not good to fly today. And I think a lot of pilots fear that because they think that flight docs are just there to take away their flying privileges.
Fun police.
Paired with, I'm pretty sure every pilot in the Air Force is locked in that flight docs only do like rectal exams. That's not true.
How'd you get your call sign?
Knuckles?
No. It is too, that's true too. I didn't really think of that aspect. And Riot, who was my flight dog, the first 2 years in the Gamblers and then Doze, Riot, still a good friend. He's going to give me grief for him not being on the podcast first because he wants to be on the podcast, but Riot, anytime you want to do it, let me know.
I think he's doing his like second residency already. I think he did like internal medicine ER. It's wild.
I still give him grief, and I gave him a lot of grief, but I have nothing but respect for Riot and really, I mean, any flight doc, but that's true. Coming into that environment, like what I mentioned before, like, hey, you know, pilots are showing up. It's people, you're kind of like, it's a known quantity. Like you got people, you know, you're used to the squadron operations. So it takes a lot to walk into a group and then kind of not force yourself, but you got to show up and you got to be there and you got to be one of the guys and integrate and overcome some of those stigmas because most guys sit in the squadron, like you don't know who the new flight doc is going to be and what they're going to be like.
It is. And I think too, right. It's knowing the system, like, because I think a lot of pilots don't know how all of the medical side of things work within the Air Force. And
100%.
Some of us as providers, I mean, when you first show up, you're like, how do I make this happen? And
you know, it's having good mentors, but also those that know the system well to be able to provide you the information. And I think if you have a mentor and you've got a few people that are there to help guide you in the right direction, like, man, you can hit it out of the park and you can take somebody's nightmare and make it a smooth sailing process. Like one of the funniest was, we had the British Exchange pilot in our squadron while I was there. and I got a call from Carney, and he was like, "Hey man, we're in Canada." And I was like, "Yeah, I'm down in Sumter." And I'm like, "Okay." And he goes, can you call Scripson up here in Canada?" And I was like, "I'm pretty sure I can't, Carney. Like my license doesn't cross the border." And he goes, "Okay." And he's like, "Well, all right." And I guess that they had had an issue where somebody had to see a doc, and you know, obviously if you're not insured in that country, like you're paying a premium dollar to get an appointment. And so I just called up the nearest pharmacy there and I was like, "Hey, you know, what can we do to help this person out?" And pharmacists up there have a little bit more rein with their license, and so they can actually take care of some minor things and see it. And so just making that, you know, 10-minute phone call saved them a significant amount of money probably, and allowed them to enjoy their time a little bit better rather than having to wait to like go see a doc up in Canada. Just like everything I've kind of hedged on, and I think, you know, a common theme that you have with everybody you've had on the podcast is it's take what you got, hit it out of the park, and then take the next step forward once the doors open or once you're ready to make the next move. How do I make the best of what I've got in front of me, and how do I become the best? Like, you know, what can I do to be the best? And that was my goal, is to, in all honesty, my goal when I showed up to Shaw was I want to be the best flight doc that any of my guys have ever had. And I want them to walk away, and I want them to leave Shaw going, "Man, I wish Knuckles was still here," or "Man, I wish I still had him as my flight doc," because I think that speaks to, you know, what you did for him and helping people out.
Yeah, that's spot on. I think if you show up anywhere and you don't want to be the best, then kind of what are you doing and what is the point of you being there would be my take on it, because you're just wasting your time if you don't be the best. That would be a perfect note to end on, but I don't want to end there because I want to kind of hear a little bit about what you're doing now, and then what's the long range plan for you?
Yeah, basically day one med school, I was like, I want to be an orthopedic surgeon. I want to work on bones. I want to fix broken bones. I want to get athletes back out running around, get, you know, people to their best functional outcome, because I think it's one of the areas of medicine that you can truly fix the problem and get somebody almost 100%, if not 100%, back to where they were prior to the injury. So luckily I got into an orthopedic surgery residency. So it's 5 years of residency. Spend your first year as what we call like an intern. You have set rotations basically each month or every 4 weeks, depending on where you're at. You are designated to a service. So whether that's working in the floors, so like internal medicine type things, or if it's doing specialty things like surgery, orthopedics, hand. And so your first year is just kind of a blend of a bunch of things to make you a well-rounded physician. And then your years 2 through 5 are more specific to actual orthopedics. My first intern year down in West Virginia, they put in the work restriction. So it was like, you can't average more than 80 hours a week over the course of 4 weeks. So you can have 1 week where you work like 100 hours a week, but then the next like 3 weeks, you have to work somewhere in the ballpark of like 60. So it's pretty wild that it wasn't until like 2014 that they were putting like work restrictions on the residency training, especially talking to some of the pilots where they're like, "Dude, I have a 12-hour duty day. That's it. And then I have to have time off." And it's like, okay. Like there were times, not when I was active duty, because it was different. We didn't have a hospital there. But there have definitely been times where it's, you show up at 6 a.m. and you're done at midnight, like the next day, and you crash at the hospital for 4 or 5 hours. You wake up at 4 a.m., you start rounding on patients, and the next thing you know, it's 9 p.m. and you're headed home. And you're like, holy cow, like where did the day go, and how did that just happen?
Isn't there something science with like lack of sleep and like equivalent to like blood alcohol content or something like that?
I think it's like if you're up for, I don't want to say it's like if you're up for 18 hours straight, like you get to the equivalent of like over the legal limit or at the legal limit roughly.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, that's crazy hours. And I think, yeah, flying wise, I definitely know when I'm getting fatigued and like I can tell I'm starting to make mistakes. If I was staying up for 36 or 48 hours or whatever, just getting like low quality sleep, like it just would not end well. I think you can push through anything short term, but my gosh.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that's they do have restrictions in there in place and safe nets, and they've done studies to figure out whether or not the restrictions are actually changing or decreasing safety issues. But, you know, I mean, it's those things where they teach you to be extremely ready and prepared for the unexpected and how to manage it.
So, and I know you're not a virologist. Do you think we're cresting the hill and like things are going to get better? Like, obviously, I think this thing is going to be around for forever and people are always going to get sick by it.
Yeah.
Is this what's new normal? What does Knuckles think about all this? Let's put you on record.
Yeah. Oh, great. Perfect. So, I mean, yeah, I will hallmark it with a big asterisk that no, I am not a virologist and no, I'm not a professional in like public health and the epidemiology side of things. But I will say one, yes, I agree. I think it's going to be around for a while in the sense of it very well could be like a flu type situation where it comes in waves every year. And, you know, they might develop a vaccine for it that's going to be similar to the flu where, you know, hopefully it provides you some better protection, but it may not be like 100% protection, like what the flu shot is. You know, are we crested? I think based on numbers, we're seeing everything starting to play out based on at least all the data that we're being provided with. I can say, like, I know at my hospital, we're definitely far better off than what we were. You know, everything is evidence-based in our world. That's the big buzzword is evidence-based medicine, where you have research to back what you're doing. This is literally the art of medicine, which is why medicine is an art. It's you're trying it based off of the best information you have that supports what you need to do, but you don't have the research backing it. And so you're kind of seeing medicine go back to where it kind of all really started from, is that they trialed and erred some things and they're like, hey, that worked. And so that's what I think you're going to run into for a little while. Probably going to see some surges here and there, especially as things start to kind of get more relaxed. But, you know, it's one of those things, there's really no telling what exactly is going to happen and how it's going to play out. But I do think that, I think you're going to run into a surge, and I think you're going to see evolution in the treatment protocol. And I think you're going to see some sort of a vaccine eventually hit the market. It's just a matter of when. And
yeah, I think this is one situation where your time in a fighter squadron would really pay off, because you can take the standard fighter pilot answer of it depends and apply it to so much here and just share with your colleagues that I think it's just blanket coverage. Like, well, it depends.
Yeah.
So there's so much, but
exactly.
Thank you for what you guys are doing, especially now all the medical professionals out there. Like, this is just such it's unprecedented. No one's ever seen it, anything like this. And there's so many unknowns and fears that go along with it. So thanks for what you and all your colleagues are doing to try and keep everyone healthy and safe. Before we get kind of wrapping up here, I wanted to say, you got any kind of like parting shots, words of advice, or anything else you think would be really beneficial for the listeners to hear besides it depends?
No, I mean, I think honestly, the biggest things are that is the flight surgeon itself within a fighter squadron can be a great asset. If you take what you have and you apply it and you do everything you can do to utilize it to the best benefit of your squadron, because you got to break down the barriers from the get-go. That's one of the biggest things that's tough to get into. It's tough to get into the squadron and feel like you're actually part of the squadron, because you are isolated, and usually the squadron commander is your boss. And he pretty much tells you, like, just do medicine and don't mess up what our game plan is as far as flying. And you're like, okay. But I think it's just, being a good person. Like, look out for the guys as if you'd look out for your family. Treat them as if they're your family, and before you know it, like, they are family.
Yep.
And I can't tell you how many guys that I have great relationships with that I catch up with on a regular basis that were, you know, tigers with me, and you're like, it's as if you never left Shaw, even though everybody's left. And you know, with that, I think it's very much back to that kind of leader is you're a leader because you serve, and you serve because you sacrifice.
Yeah.
I think if you do those things, and it doesn't just apply to, you know, flight medicine, I think that applies to everything, you know, in life, is if you want to be a leader, like, you've got to serve. And if you serve, you've got to sacrifice, to get there. And I think those are things that, you know, if you apply those to every facet of life, like, man, you're going to hit home runs left and right. And people are going to sit there and look at you and go, this is an awesome dude. Like, I want this dude on my team. And so I think it's just, you know, take what you got. You're not always going to get the card you want dealt. When you get the cards you are dealt, take them, run with them, make the best of it, do the best with what you got, and wait for your opportunities to open up. Because if you're driven to do things, and you're driven and you want to do something, like, the doors may close at certain times, but you'd be amazed how many times those doors open back up periodically throughout. And I think, like, in my life, I've seen that so many times, where I was told I couldn't serve in the Air Force, and then I served. You know, I was told I couldn't do orthopedics, and then the door opened to go do this flight medicine, which was a opportunity second to none, predominantly with just being in a fighter squadron of one. Like, I never thought I'd be sitting behind on an engine like that. Man, like, just the opportunities to be there, and then to have my family be able to experience that with me, it's just awesome. And then, you know, to finish it all off with the opportunity to go into the residency that I wanted to do, like, I can't be more thankful for my time, for the people that I have, you know, met, and just being able to do that to finally get here. It's been an awesome experience. And I mean, a lot of props to you guys. Like, as pilots, like, you guys, you know, I think it's very easy for people in the military to see that you guys just show up and you fly and you go home. Like, there is so much more behind that than what people know. And I think flight docs get the unique experience of seeing that, like, all of the preparation you guys do for your flights and all of the training that you guys do just to go fly, like, a single sortie. There is so much more behind it to get to that point. And then, for me to, like, watch those dudes, like, I watched, you know, lieutenants show up, and then they, like, I was with the Tigers for 4 years, and literally watched some guys show up as lieutenants straight out of the B course who left Shaw, and they were IPs. And I mean, to watch a dude grow like that there's very few opportunities, I think, in your life to watch somebody grow in that fashion. And I think the opportunity to see that so young in my life is just awesome. Because you see somebody coming in and barely knowing anything to him being the wisdom for these guys who just showed up.
No doubt.
And so it's just awesome to see that. And I think that the fighter squadron and the Air Force definitely breeds that, where you get the opportunity to watch that, because there are a lot of opportunities put in front of you to take the hammer and run. And if you do it and you do it well, like, people know. If you do it and you don't do so hot, people know, but they give you another opportunity. And I think that's the thing, is you got to know that you're going to fumble a little bit, but pick it back up and go with it. Cause you'll get there. It just may take you a couple tries.
Yeah. Got to keep at it. Well, Knuckles, really appreciate you coming on the podcast tonight. It was awesome being able to fly, cause you and I flew, it was like your last day. Right. Or day before. Yeah. You turned in my paperwork, which is really cool.
I turned my paperwork in the next day, and I got my final wave goodbye, and off I went.
So I'll definitely share some of those videos on Instagram so people can see that. But again,
you shared the one clip already.
Yeah. Well, I only got like 15 minutes of footage. So there's plenty of interaction though.
Something. It's a short flight, but it feels like forever.
Right. Oh, well, no, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast again. It was great catching up, and thanks for taking the time to be on here.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Rand. Appreciate it. And best of luck with the podcast, man. It's great listening. And some of the guys you brought on, man, you listen to stories, you're like, holy cow. Like, that's awesome. So you got a lot of great people. And I mean, I think that speaks to you is, you know, you've put yourself around these guys and surrounded yourself with great people. So good job.
I'm very fortunate. So I really appreciate that. Thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. Again, wherever you're listening, hit subscribe. And if you can, leave me a rating and review over on iTunes. That definitely helps out. Until next time,
don't bring it weak.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.